This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson on WLRN. Healthcare reform, voting rights, and gun control. It's Florida versus the feds. The state of Florida is fighting the federal government on all three issues, squaring off between congressional mandates, laws, and states' rights. The latest dust-up coming this week in Florida with the Attorney General Pam Bondi joining the fight to overturn a 1968 federal gun statute banning the sale of handguns to 18 to 20-year-olds. This is where we begin the Florida Roundup, the week that was, and digging behind the news and the newsmakers with Steve Bosquet from the Tampa Bay Times and Tolo Olorunipa from Bloomberg News, both joining us from Tallahassee. Steve, first of all, why is Florida joining this state fight against this gun control law that's been in place for the better part of a generation?
Well, the obvious first answer is that the political leadership of the state is strongly in support of and in close alignment with the NRA's agenda. We are a solidly pro-gun, pro-Second Amendment state. It's politically probably the most popular thing to do. Gun rights is always an issue in every governor's race, and if we want to get to that in a minute, there's some fascinating dynamics involving Charlie Crist and Rick Scott. But the mindset is that if you're old enough to fight for your country and old enough to vote, you're old enough to own a gun.
Yeah, that's the mindset here, and that's the argument, essentially, not necessarily the legal argument that the states are making here, Steve, but more about the cultural argument that they're making. Conversely, though, there's no state that's going to argue 18 to 20-year-olds ought to have the legal right to buy alcohol. So we make differences based upon age and the ability to discern responsibility.
Yeah, that's correct. I do think that they're going to have a tough row to hoe at the Supreme Court here. I think that because I think we have a I think we had a Circuit Court of Appeals decision that was very strong and unanimous that upheld the current restriction on 18 to 20-year-olds buying owning handguns.
Yeah. Tolo, Steve already has brought politics into this because you have to bring it in right away when talking about gun control in Florida. From your position with Bloomberg News, you're looking not only at the state of Florida but also elsewhere in the Southeast in the United States here. How does this gun control fight with the NRA and Florida on one side versus Congress on the other? How's this play out?
Well, this is another opportunity for a red state or a state that's run by Republicans to show their opposition against the Obama administration.
But to be clear, this is not an Obama administration law. This is an LBJ law.
Right. This is a law that goes very far back, and the Obama administration has sort of come down on one side of the gun control debate, trying to pass further controls earlier this year in an effort that didn't pass in the House and the Senate. So this is one way for the states, which are actually 30 states are run by Republicans, 20 are run by Democrats. This is a way for the states to announce their independence from the White House, from the federal government, which is dominated by the Democrat Party at the time.
Yep, and we've seen it time and time again here with other issues we'll talk about in a moment. Join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN by calling 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576. Email us, tweet us at WLRN, and join the conversation, a live chat ongoing online at WLRN.org. I'm Tom Hudson, Steve Bosquet from the Tampa Bay Times, and Tolo Olorunipa from Bloomberg News. Join us as we talk about Florida against the federal government. And Steve, you brought politics into this and some interesting dynamics beginning to emerge here as we look toward the gubernatorial race. Put those dynamics in the context of this latest gun control fight that the Scott administration is squaring up against the federal government.
Okay. The Democrats are in an unusual bind and position here where their most likely and their most likely effective candidate for governor is Charlie Crist, who used to be a Republican, then became an independent, and is now a Democrat. In fact, he spent time this week in South Florida working to build and expand his base down there. Charlie Crist has always been unwavering in his support of the NRA. He has been decidedly pro-gun. Now he's running under the party banner of the party that is generally in favor of stricter gun control regulations. So I don't know how it's going to play out. I mean, I don't know whether his position on guns is evolving or whether it's been consistent. And so we're going to have to see. Rick Scott, on the other hand, of course, is solidly in support of this legal action the state is taking.
Yeah. In the meantime, Tolo, we've got to obviously stand your ground after the George Zimmerman case, which is going to be in focus yet again with the legislative session coming up in the springtime.
Exactly. That's another policy and political issue that will be it's interesting to see how it plays out. Stand Your Ground is a bill that passed under Jeb Bush, mm-hmm. but Charlie Crist supported it and supported further gun rights laws after that passed. Now there are calls to repeal Stand Your Ground, and the governor said he doesn't want to repeal it. Some of the Democrats have filed bills to repeal it, and the House Speaker said that they would hold a hearing on the bill to see if it needs to be changed, even though he said that it doesn't need to be repealed. So it will be an interesting issue going into the fall and, of course, going into the next legislative session to see if any changes happen next year.
And, Steve, how does that color kind of the squaring up of the positions when it comes to firearms for the upcoming governor's race, as you mentioned?
I don't think there's much support politically to make much of a change to the Stand Your Ground law in Florida. I did see this week where Representative Dennis Baxley of Ocala, who sponsored the original bill in 2005, is willing to sort of look at changes, but they won't be significant. They just won't be. And guns are even more of an issue as we go into a governor's race. I mean, it's an even-numbered year next year. There's going to be an election not just for governor but for all the way up and down the ballot. Politicians, you have to remember— we had a Democratic candidate for governor here, Rod Smith, the former state attorney from Gainesville. He's solidly pro-Second Amendment. It's dangerous territory for a statewide candidate in Florida to be aggressively supporting stricter gun control laws.
And so as this case possibly goes before the Supreme Court, we're talking about the case that the Attorney General of Florida, Pam Bondi, joined with a better part of more than a dozen other states and the NRA to fight to repeal a 1968 federal statute that bans the sale of handguns to 18 to 20-year-olds. The Supreme Court is still weighing whether or not to consider this. Let's presume for a moment, which is always difficult when talking about legal cases, let's presume for a moment this does go before the Supreme Court. How much of an issue does this play into a governor's race, statewide races, local races, as the Florida economy continues to limp along? And as we saw today on the national scale, the unemployment rate is ticking down as fewer and fewer people are considered part of the workforce. So in other words, balance, I guess, the economics that the electorate is dealing with versus some of these social issues.
I would say that it's probably an issue with a very, very small sliver of the electorate, people who are really passionate about the Second Amendment, either one side or the other. But the dominant issue in the governor's race in 2014 is going to be about jobs and the economy, and it's going to be a referendum on what kind of a job Rick Scott has done.
Yep. Tolo, from your position, do you see it the same way?
Yes, mostly I see it the same way. This election is going to be about the economy. There will be some social issues, and the governor spoke before a crowd of Tea Partiers last week, and he did throw out some red meat on things like testing welfare workers, gun rights, other social issues where that will appeal to a slice of the electorate, and it's going to be an election about turning out the base. So as much as the economy will be the number one issue to turn out the base, sometimes you need to talk about guns and social issues, and that's going to happen on both sides of the aisle.
Well, social issues and economic issues come together with the issue of health care. Handgun ownership for teenagers is just this latest issue that Florida officials have fought with federal lawmakers. Governor Rick Scott has been very critical of the Affordable Care Act and its mandate that individuals have health insurance beginning next year. Here's the governor this summer.
Prison healthcare law is a disaster. It's going to be bad for patients. It's going to be bad for businesses. It's going to be bad for providers. There's nobody that wins in that bill.
One out of four Floridians lack health insurance. That's 3.8 million people without coverage. Tolo, you've covered this from the get-go. Is Florida ready for healthcare reform?
Well, in some ways, our state government has sort of washed its hands of the quote-unquote Obamacare initiative that's supposed to start this year. We have basically denied the expansion of Medicaid. We've rejected that. We've decided not to participate in the state-based exchange program. We've allowed the federal government basically to take the reins, and in some ways we've thrown up roadblocks to the federal government. It's partly a political issue. It's partly an issue of the state just not wanting to be involved in Obamacare. It is something that will be interesting to see, because October 1st is when this this new law is supposed to go into effect, and in many ways the state has tried not to participate.
Right, right. It's when the open enrollment of these health state exchanges, Steve, is due to begin, with obviously the individual mandate coming in play the first of the calendar year. Tolo mentioned some of the roadblocks that the Scott administration has thrown up. Most recently, Steve, it's been about privacy concerns. Is any of this gathering any speed, any support?
No, I don't think so, but a couple of points here. First of all, I think Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, is trying to have it both ways. He wants to bash Obamacare as a disaster, as he did in that audio clip you played. Yet let's remember history. He wanted the legislature to approve a 3-year expansion of the Medicaid program and accept the billions of dollars in federal money that went with it.
Right.
And the legislature refused to go along. Largely, it was the opposition of one man, Will Weatherford, the Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives, who stopped Medicaid expansion in the state. I've seen a lot of polls on this issue, and frankly, it's not overwhelming. That is, the public favors Medicaid expansion, but not by an overwhelming margin. So you could argue both ways in terms of how it cuts politically. The question is, groups like the AARP, which speaks for the retiree population, mm-hmm. and groups like the Service Employees International Union, which is a big and very vocal healthcare union in this state, the question is going to be how much of a role they want to play in pushing healthcare and the uninsured as a campaign issue in 2014.
And we should point out, both of those organizations obviously have very strong get-out-the-vote efforts when it comes to the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, which brings us to the third issue of voting rights, another Florida versus the Fed fight here, as the Sunshine State's been pushing hard to purge voting rolls of non-citizens. The governor was emboldened just this summer, this past spring, with the Supreme Court striking down part of the 1964 Voting Rights Act that did require the federal government's okay before some states change voting laws. That's been thrown out. Steve, is this a trend of states' rights on the part of the Scott administration, or can we take each of these, gun control, health care, and voting, as individual issues, or rather, is this something more philosophical?
I think it's more a case-by-case situation. And now that we're on the subject of the so-called voter purges or scrubbing the voter rolls, it's a fascinating issue from a political science and political point of view. I think it's nothing but one big headache for this administration. In defense of Rick Scott, his statement is the following. A person who's not a citizen of the state should not be voting in an election. Nobody would disagree with that. And when a non-citizen casts a ballot, it dilutes the vote of a law-abiding citizen who has the right to vote. However, when they tried this last year, it was a disaster, and we had law-abiding citizens being forced to sort of defend their citizenship and prove their citizenship. The burden of proof shouldn't be on the individual, it should be on the state of Florida.
Right.
And secondly, we've already had one supervisor of elections, and it's in my newspaper's hometown, Pinellas County, Deborah Clark, who is a Republican, by the way, who has said she's washed her hands. She's not going to do this. When the state sends her names of suspected ineligible voters, she's not going to deal with it because it's more trouble than it's worth, and it is a public relations nightmare for local election supervisors.
And Tolo, obviously Florida is not unique in this regard in terms of voting purges and really beginning to battle against some of the federal mandates regarding oversight of voting. But does it stand out in its efforts here to try to stand up for what its supporters are deeming as state rights issues, gun control, health care, and voting being these three latest examples?
Well, one thing that does stand out about this voter purge is it's in a larger context of Florida having issues and problems at the ballot box, specifically last year, the long lines that we saw. We also saw the voter purge that was very flawed last year, and the list that came out was predominantly made up of Hispanic-sounding names and Democrats more so than Republicans. So when you throw that all together, it does make Florida a little bit of a unique case. And Florida is one of the states where the Republican Party is looking to rebuild itself, reach out to minorities, reach out to the Hispanic voters, and things like the voter purge. Many analysts and many political watchers basically say is not going to help in that effort.
Tolo Olorunipa, Bloomberg News from Tallahassee. Steve Bosque from the Tampa Bay Times, also from the capital city. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson on WLRN. Join us at 800-743-WLRN. Punch into the phone, 800-743-9576. Email us at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com, thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. Tweet us at WLRN or join the conversation at WLRN.org, that online discussion hosted by our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow. Still to come on the Florida Roundup, we will be talking about, so far, the storm season that hasn't been. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
It's almost like a train coming through your house.
It sounded like a train.
A freight train.
And just how the building was shaking.
It reverberates the entire house inside my head.
From our documentary, Remembering Andrew, the sound and fury of Hurricane Andrew 21 years ago. It was the last Category 5 hurricane to hit South Florida. And 21 years ago today, most of South Dade County was still without power surveying the destruction from that storm. Now, fast forward better part of two decades, this year's storm season, it's been awfully quiet. The season is half over now, and there have not been any Atlantic hurricanes. August was the calmest it had been since 2002. Jeff Huffman is a meteorologist for Florida Public Radio. He joins us from Gainesville. Jeff, first of all, give us an update on Gabrielle. This was the latest tropical storm that kind of flared up in the Caribbean over the past couple of days.
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom. Gabrielle is no longer. It dissipated overnight, now just a remnant low and really actually undefined in terms of where it's at. It has pretty much vanished. We've had trouble keeping storms alive this year here.
Yeah, why have we had the quiet season? What are the forces that have been at play?
Well, at this point in the season, there's several theories out there as to why it's been quiet. It's a little hard to pin that down. It's more of a head-scratcher right now, but we really didn't have that unusual amount of dry air coming off of Africa. You got to really look to Africa first, especially this time of year, to see what may be keeping storms from forming. We had the typical dust storms and the dry air through July and August. That has dissipated. We have convective activity and moisture now in the Atlantic. In fact, when you look at the number of named storms so far, it's not been that unusual. But as you mentioned, it's hurricanes.
Yeah, the pace has been okay, but the intensity, the normal historic intensity, simply hasn't been there. Back in May, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicted a very active storm season, up to 11 hurricanes. Then they put that back in August down to 9. So, as we get later in the season, are we talking about the pace and the velocity maybe picking up?
I'm not sure the pace would pick up, but possibly the velocity. You know, wind shear can obviously rip storms apart as they're trying to develop, and that has been a factor at times. I've, at this point in the season, all I can say right now, it's a combination of timing and location. We've had waves coming off of Africa. We've had spin-ups. But maybe they've come at the inopportune time in terms of wind shear and also location, especially when we look out to the west coast of Africa in the next couple of days. We're likely to have a significant development there, but something that forms that far out of the sea, most of the time does not make it all the way across the big pond. So yeah. At this time, I think it's the combination of timing and location.
Give us a quick update on what you see for the next 10 days.
Well, we have several areas of interest out there. One in the western Gulf, that's moving to Mexico, no threat to Florida. We actually do have a wave near where Gabrielle was. Got to watch that closely over the weekend, but it's likely to slowly move back out to sea, even if it does develop. Something may spin up in the next 5 to 10 days off the west coast of Africa. Tom, at this point in the season, I'm more concerned about what may happen in October and November closer to home. You know, later in the season, you move it back closer to home. You see storms develop in the Caribbean and the Gulf. And once again, I think that may be our best chance, if you will, for something to possibly impact the United States.
You can never rest too easy. Jeff Huffman, meteorologist for Florida Public Radio, joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Steve Bosquet of the Tampa Bay Times and Tola Olorunipa Bloomberg News, also still with us from Tallahassee. It has been a quiet storm season, not only for us here in South Florida, but obviously up and down the eastern seaboard. It's been good news, I suppose, for the insurers. But let's talk about Citizens Insurance, the largest windstorm insurance carrier in the state of Florida, backed by every single Florida taxpayer. Tolo, we've seen a new round of takeouts. Tell us a little bit about this week.
Right. Citizens reign as the number one and largest insurer in the in Florida may be coming to an end. There are about 400,000 policies at Citizens that private insurers have targeted and said that after this storm season, they want to take over. They've been doing these takeouts for several years as the private insurance market has started to bolster itself up. Now they see that Citizens has made a lot of money over the last 7 years with no hurricanes, and they want to take over some of those lucrative policies and take them out of Citizens. And, of course, the taxpayers and the state government wants that risk off the books of the state, so they're more than happy to send those policies over to the private industry.
Tolo, give us a little bit more clarity on the process here. Are these policies that Citizens chooses, or are these policies that these private insurers go into the Citizen roles and say, oh, we like this kind of risk, these are the ones we want?
Well, Citizens in the state are very eager to get rid of this risk, so they have opened their books and opened their doors to the private insurers, who get to look at the books of Citizens and gets to look at which policies are lucrative and
right,
don't have claims. So these private insurers are the ones sort of picking, and some say cherry picking, the policies that they want out of the Citizens book, which right now is at about 1.2 million policies.
Steve, I'm always reminded of buy low and sell high. And as Tolo mentioned, a quiet 7 years in terms of hurricane damage, especially in South Florida, which is usually in the crosshairs every season. You got to ask yourself, are some of these smaller companies perhaps trying to buy some of these policies low when risk has been low for 7 years?
Yes, they are. And it has been unusually quiet.
Yep.
You know, I'm going to tell an anecdote, and some of your listeners may chuckle and laugh, but in 2007, former Governor Charlie Crist went to Israel on a trade mission. While he's over there, he writes a handwritten note and says words to the effect, "Please, God, take care of Florida, protect us." And he sticks this handwritten note into the wall, the Great Wall in Jerusalem. We haven't been tested by a major storm since Chris did that. I'll just leave it at that.
Draw your own conclusions.
Here's another quick point. You know, there's no greater test of a partnership between the state and federal government than in a hurricane.
Yep.
Earlier in this broadcast, we've talked about how Rick Scott calls Obamacare a disaster. He didn't like federal stimulus money. He turned away the high-speed rail money. And I could go on and on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting. Who's head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency for the United States? It's a guy named Craig Fugate. He's a Floridian. He's from Gainesville.
Mm-hmm.
And so the partnership that exists between the state and federal government probably right now is as good as it could ever be politically and organizationally. And yet it's been an amazingly historically quiet time for storms.
Yeah, certainly has. And thankful for all the homeowners throughout the state of Florida, obviously. But also, let's face it, the insurance companies here, as they are seeing the profit motive. And that's, after all, what stimulates supply and demand. These new 10 companies, Tolo, that are moving in to try to choose these 400,000 policies, what do we know about their ability to withstand a regular storm season?
That's a good question. Some of these are newer companies, and they weren't around during the storm seasons, the most recent storm season. So some of them have been created after the storm seasons in 2004 and 2005. So we don't know how strong they may be if they get hit. They're quote unquote untested. Some of them have been around a little bit longer. Citizens' track record with these takeout companies isn't necessarily great. I think between 2007 and 2011. 6 out of 18 companies that did takeouts went bankrupt, and that was during a time of no storms. So these companies have much less money in the bank than Citizens, which has about $6.5 billion that it's built up over the last 7 years. So also last year, some of these companies were so financially challenged that Citizens was actually paying them money
right,
to take over the policies in order to have a strong enough balance sheet. So There is some question about whether these companies could handle a large storm, but for the most part, Citizens in the Office of Insurance Regulation feel comfortable that they will be.
It feeds the constant controversy when it comes to the price of risk and insurance in the state of Florida. On one hand, Citizens being so large and being backed by state taxpayers. On the other hand, some of these smaller companies that are being encouraged to move into the market that may not be quite ready to take the kind of risk that you have to take here in the Sunshine State.
Back in 2011, I got a letter from Citizens regarding my home being taken out from the Citizens Property and Casualty, and I said, well, that's great. I'm going to a private company. Known to be that Citizens doesn't look at the financials of each individual company that's going into the takeout. After I was transferred over to the takeout within 3 months, That company went into bankruptcy, and I lost my policy and had to go back to Citizens, losing substantial money.
A caller to our Public Insight Network here on WLRN in the Florida Roundup, and Tolo, it speaks right to that issue of maybe immature companies, not immature operators, but immature companies that don't have the kind of capital cushions that you need, even in the good times, to be able to withstand. So what kind of safeguards are these new 400,000 Citizens policyholders going to be seeing that the companies that want their business now are going to be around next year, the year after that, the year after that?
It's a good question. These policies or these companies do have the approval from the Office of Insurance Regulation, so that gives them a certain level of experience. Unfortunately, some of the companies that were approved by OIR have gone bankrupt, so there is no guarantee. And one thing that homeowners need to know is that they're going to get letters from Citizens and from this, or not from Citizens, but from these new companies saying that we're going to take over your policy, and they're going to have to opt out within 30 days if they want to stay with Citizens.
So they do have a choice, right?
Yes, people do have a choice, but it's something that they would have to proactively do if they want to stay with Citizens. They can't. It's not an opt-in process. It's an opt-out process. So some people have complained about that and said, you know, I didn't check my mail or I wasn't in town, and 30 days later, I find that I have a new insurer and I have no idea whether or not they would have the money to pay the claim after a storm.
Yeah, let us know if you've gotten one of those letters in your inbox lately. Give us a call at 800-743-9576. Here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN, it's 800-743-9576. Join the online chat at WLRN.org or give us a tweet at WLRN. Justin joins us from Lighthouse Point. Justin, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I had a question regarding Citizens in a statement as well. I guess the first question is really how underfunded is Citizens if every policy in Florida is already essentially subsidizing Citizens with some sort of line item tax? And then also, in addition, the 40% assessment after a catastrophic storm, which the private companies cannot assess, but Citizens can. And the question there is, what's the likelihood of Citizens being able to recoup that 40% assessment after the fact?
All right.
So I'll take your answer off the air.
Thank Justin you. From Lighthouse Point. Tola, let's tackle that first, that last question first here. The ability of Citizens to essentially claw back because it has the support of the state legislator and essentially is backed by all Floridians.
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess the first thing to mention is that in order for that huge 45% assessment to take place, we'd have to have a monster massive storm, and that's in part because Citizens has built up about $6.5 billion in cash. They have billions more in backup insurance. So we're talking about a storm maybe twice the size of Andrew before we get to that 45% assessment.
Right.
And there is a question as to whether, you know, whether the state would be able to pick that up. It would be spread out over maybe about 30 years, and it would cost, you know, maybe $50 to $100 extra per policy per year. But there are people who may not be able to afford that, and some of the Citizens policyholders would have to pay much more because they have to bear the bulk of the assessment.
You know, in fact, back in the springtime or early summer, we spoke with the CEO of Citizens, Tolo, and we asked him just those questions in terms of the company's ability to withstand a couple of good-sized storms. And essentially it was, they've got enough resources for one storm, they don't have enough resources for two storms in the same season. And to your point, and you know these kind of capital global investment markets, odds are if there were two significant storms and Citizens sees things going in the red, they'd have to tap into those markets and essentially issue bonds backed by Floridians over the course of the next generation to be paid back.
Yes, that is true. If they were to run out of cash, if they were to run out of their backup insurance because of one storm or because of one very large storm or because of two significant storms, they would have to go into the capital markets. And that is a question as to, you know, what the markets would look like after a major storm. Would it be more expensive to borrow money? Would it be even possible to borrow money? Those are some of the concerns, some of the worst case scenarios that Citizens has run. And that's in part why they're trying so desperately to get policies off their books and into the private market, where the private insurers end up holding that risk.
Steve, I want to ask you about maybe the politics of Citizens as we move back into that gubernatorial season, hopefully after this quiet storm season here. Is this going to bubble up at all if as Citizen continues to try to depopulate itself and these Florida homeowners are likely going to see higher rates of risk insurance based upon market data, not based upon the size of the state moving in as the insurer of last resort?
Absolutely. In fact, I think Citizens and property insurance generally is the true sort of, I'd call it the sleeping giant of political issues in this state that politicians don't talk about enough. There's a special election going on in Pasco County, which, as you know, is just north of Tampa,
right,
which includes a coastal area, to replace Mike Fasano, who left the House to become a tax collector. And Fasano was a loud voice, a populist voice against Citizens, a lot of the things Citizens was doing. There was a Republican platform debate the other night, and insurance was never discussed, and Fasano was astounded by that. So the point is, politicians in the state are missing an opportunity by not talking about this issue more than they should.
Yeah.
I'm a little concerned about the timing of this big takeout program. Tolu and I were talking about it off the air, because drive up and down A1A, drive through Ponte Vedra Beach this time of year. It's still basically summer in Florida. What do you see? You see boarded up windows with hurricane shutters, because those people who own those beachfront condos are in New York. They're in the Carolina Mountains. They're on Cape Cod. You know, what if they're not checking their mail and they're shifted to another company without their consent?
Mm-hmm.
I see a potential backlash here, big time.
All right. We are talking about Citizens Insurance and the depopulation that continued this week with the announcement of 400,000 additional Florida homeowners trying to be taken out of the Florida risk pool. This is the Florida Roundup. Michael joins the conversation from Broward County. Michael, go ahead.
Yes, hello. I appreciate your program here. I was, before the opt-out, was actually engaged. I was dumped by Citizens or United Joint Underwriters way back when it was called that. I was dumped into two companies that subsequently went out of business. Then I was dumped back into Citizens. So I've been, over the last 15 years, I've been through the mill. The second one was during Wilma, which I needed a new roof. The company went out of business in the middle of the claim. I had to go to the guarantee fund to complete the claim. It's been quite a nightmare. I've gotten since then, okay, now I'm with Citizens, okay, but I've gotten, probably over the last 3 years, a half a dozen opt-outs. I have to continually send these opt-outs in to say, I don't want to be with your company because I don't know, I never heard of your company. I have a question, and I don't know if somebody can answer it. How do I went to my insurance agent, and I asked, you know, these companies, this company, is this any good? Is this company any good? They don't seem to really know. And I don't, evaluate these companies? Because, you know, fool me once, fool me twice. How many times do I have to, you know, join up with companies and then get they go out of business?
Michael from Broward County really voicing the concerns that a number of homeowners have here, Tolo, who are in that kind of opt-out scenario, continuously seeing private insurers come in, private insurers that just don't have a lot of history in the market. So where do you go for that information?
Yeah, it can be incredibly difficult, and sometimes it's sort of like being between a rock and a hard place. You do want to find out about these companies, because you don't want to leave Citizens, which is a well-capitalized, highly experienced insurer, and go to an undercapitalized fly-by-night insurer who may not be here in the hard times. The one thing you can do is you can talk to your insurance agent. You can talk to folks at the Office of Insurance Regulation. You can even talk to Citizens and find out a little bit more about these companies, because Citizens also looks at the companies that want to take policies off of its books. It can be difficult because there are dangers to staying with Citizens as well, because if there is a major storm, if the company does run out of money, it is going to cause Citizens policyholders to pay large assessments.
Yeah, that's
so
right. There is no
those are two
there
things
is,
to think about.
Absolutely, there's no risk without reward. The reward of Citizens is usually a lower premium. The risk, of course, is in the event of a very busy and very disastrous storm season, is Citizens going to have the wherewithal to support those claims? Tim, final comment here from Fort Lauderdale as we talk about insurance coverage with the storm season. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, hi. How are you? Two quick comments.
In my case, I never received an opt-out letter. What I received was a letter saying that because I had not chosen to opt out, I was being placed with another company. But I never received the initial letter. I called my agent. They didn't seem to know much about it either. That was a couple months ago. Even if I had received the letter, there would have been no information about policy premiums or any other, you know, financial information to make a decision anyway.
Yeah, Tim from Fort Lauderdale.
That 3 days.
Yeah, and the real difficulty here, Tolo, is the transparency in this depopulation process seems to be incredibly lacking. Not only information on some of these new companies, simply because the information isn't there, and then secondly, the conversation and the communication between citizens, the private industry, and of course the insurance brokers that are on the front lines of customers and policyholders like Tim.
Well, people want to know, if I go to this new company, how much are they going to charge me? And that's another danger, because they aren't required to tell you what the new price is going to be when you renew. Citizens is protected by a 10% cap. So if you stay with Citizens, your rates will probably go up, but no more than by 10% each year.
Yeah.
If you go to a private company, it could be much more.
Welcome to doing business with us. We're not going to tell you how much we're going to charge you, but thank you for your business nonetheless. All right. We need to thank a couple of guys here. Steve Bosquet from the Tampa Bay Times in Tallahassee. Tolo Olorunipa from Bloomberg News. Guys, thank you so much for navigating all these waters with us. Still to come here on the Florida Roundup, history made this week in Key West.
Come on, man. This is Geezer Palooza. She's our queen.
Five attempts. 35 years, and Diane Nyad walks out of the ocean in Key West to a cheering crowd, having completed her swim from Cuba to Key West without a shark cage. An unbelievable feat of dedication, of strength of mind and body. Don Vanatta from ESPN joins us here in studio, and WLRN's Alicia Zuckerman. Alicia, an amazing feat, and you had an opportunity to talk to her a few days after this swim. First of all, how was she doing physically?
Well, a few days after the swim, she sounded great. I was told by her handlers that she was really, really exhausted. I was originally supposed to interview for about a half an hour, and they asked if I could make it shorter. So I was expecting to hear a much more tired-sounding person. I was amazed by how vigorous she sounded, given the circumstances. And I asked her, one of the things I asked her about was why, I mean, this was her fifth try from Cuba to Key West.
Right.
Why that swim?
And the third try in 3 years. That's
what's
really amazing.
Right.
This try, the initial try, Don, began back in what, the mid 70s?
In 1978.
And then she did a second one in the 80s, I believe it was.
I think it might have been later than that.
Maybe
it
later
might
than
have
that.
Been. She gave up swimming for 30 years.
2010, 2011, 2012.
Yeah.
Three more tries. I mean, unbelievable.
Right. Yeah. No, it's incredible. I mean, given her age and, you know, everything. I mean, you heard that guy say Geezer Palooza, which I think he meant with a lot of love. It's very Key West. But anyway, so I one of the things I asked her about, though, was why. I mean, she just, after every swim, she said, after every one of these attempts, she said, never again, I'm not doing it. Or at least after the last few, she said, I'm not doing it, I'm done. It was very funny. She actually said, you know, it's a rude question when you get out of the water after an attempt and people say, so are you going to do it again?
Right.
She actually sounded annoyed that reporters kept asking her that question. But she decided that, you know, it just like after a little bit of time passed, every time, nope, I'm going to try it again. I'm going to get back in the water in Havana. 6 months of paperwork every time just to be able to swim from Havana. And so I asked her about that. Why was this particular swim so important of any endurance swim she could have done?
The Earth is 4/5 ocean. So really, you could swim any stretch. But to my mind, it's not interesting. It's not inspiring unless there's some story to be told. And what a story Cuba is. This is forbidden territory. They have not been able to come here, and we haven't been able to go there. And so there's something, obviously, too, with people trying to swim across just by sheer survival to get out of Cuba. It's got deep roots to it, the story.
You know, one of the interesting things about her being so interested in the story of this swim, so it's beyond the feat of athleticism, you know, she's a journalist, too, a radio journalist at that. She's done work for Marketplace and All Things Considered, and I think The Savvy Traveler, which, of course, makes all of us in the newsroom kind of reevaluate our own gym membership. What else should we be doing after hours? So, you know, the story, it was really interesting to hear that the story was so important to her.
Don Van Atta from ESPN, you know, after this incredible feat and she walked up on shore of Key West, you heard from a number of South Floridians with those deep roots in Cuba saying, you know, I've been down to that southernmost point. I've sat on that buoy and I've looked south and I've thought only 90 miles away. It becomes that much closer even with this incredible physical feat, doesn't it?
Absolutely. She narrowed that distance and she made it, she imagined it and then she made it happen. And I have to say, you know, in 2011, I was one of those rude reporters that asked her that question after her third attempt. I think I was the first reporter who talked to her. And she said it was a fairy tale. But the fairy tale had to come to an end. And I remembered that Saturday afternoon. I was swept up in it. I was on Twitter, tweeting away, following it, you know, moment by moment.
Were you on the beach?
I wasn't on the beach. I was at home. But I was just, because I just so love her spirit and, you know, her grit, and remembered that conversation I had with her, and to watch her do it, I really was swept up in it. And it's just, it's a phenomenal thing. And to do it at 64 is just, is absolutely incredible.
And I think that's, Alicia, another part of the story that we've heard from, shall we call them, the mature communities. I don't want to say senior citizens. We're all getting older. Time moves in one direction and one speed. That's all I know. That's all I've learned on this time in this sphere. But it really has struck a chord regardless of age.
Yeah, no, it really has. I swim. I do laps. And I've you know, like nothing compared, you know, it looks like I'm swimming in a kiddie pool compared to what she does. You know, the most I've ever swum is actually 1 mile, and it takes me about an hour. But, you know, that day, I mean, the feeling of inspiration in watching something like this happen is immense. That day, I felt compelled to make myself go to the pool in Flamingo Park, you know, and do my laps and swim. And some part of me was definitely swimming for Dan and Nyad in that particular time. And I think a lot of people, senior citizens, not senior citizens, across the board, felt like, man, look at what she could do. I'm going to try to get out there and do something too.
And just to pick up on your point about her being a journalist, that's the other thing. She's a storyteller. And, you know, one of the hashtags that her team had was the other shore. Mm-hmm. Just the other shore is just this magical phrase.
Across the horizon.
And that message to never, ever give up really, I think, resonates with people no matter what your age is.
Don Van Atta from ESPN, Alicia Zuckerman with WLRN here on the Florida Roundup. Now, it's interesting, the coverage and commentary to this incredible spectacle that we saw in Key West. It was about the feat, the dedication, her age, but it was not about her gender. We didn't see a lot of mention about her gender. But back in 1973, Don, it was a very different athletic contest that was solely about gender. I mean, it was the name. It was called the Battle of the Sexes on the tennis court. Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King.
The following is an exclusive presentation of ABC Sports. What a scene it is, almost reminiscent of college football, with the celebrities present, with the big band here, with dancing cheerleaders, and all of the rest.
And all of the rest included Bobby Riggs losing to Billie Jean King. And Don, it's been speculated for years that the match was thrown. You write about it recently for ESPN, and the Florida connection involved here.
Yes, we interviewed a man from Tampa named Hal Shaw, who's now 79 years old. He was 39 40 years ago, and he was in a country club pro shop late at night, and several men came in, unbeknownst to them. He was hiding behind a door, and he heard them say an incredible thing. They were mobsters. He recognized two of them as mobsters, Santo Traficante Jr. From Tampa, a infamous Florida mobster, and Carlos Marcello of New Orleans, another infamous mobster of the 20th century, and a man named Frank Regano, who was an attorney and a member at this country club, Pomacea, in Tampa. And Hal Shaw told us for this story that he heard them describe a proposal brought to them by Bobby Riggs to throw the match with Billie Jean King.
And what was the why? What was the intent? Obviously, there was some kind of financial payoff, but why was he willing to essentially take that reputational risk?
Shaw heard the men say that Bobby Riggs owed them more than $100,000 of a gambling debt, and he also wanted money put into a bank account for him in England to do this. And one of the things we found in this investigation that I did is actually Bobby Riggs had a lot of friends across the country in the mob, in South Florida, in Chicago, and in California.
Well, he was also known as a kind of a huckster, kind of a gambler type, right?
He was a hustler, a big gambler, gambled on everything. He gambled on things he could control, like tennis and golf, but he also gambled on things he couldn't control, like football, college and pro football. He bet on a lot of that in the early 70s. And so we interviewed everybody, including Billie Jean King, for this piece that aired on Outside the Lines on ESPN, as well as was on ESPN.com. And it's had quite an impact.
Yeah, it gives this story another chapter, another new life. Are you convinced that that Riggs is guilty?
I'm not convinced. I think we build a very strong circumstantial case that raises major new questions about whether he threw the match or not. But I'm not absolutely convinced. And I should say that Billie Jean King, who I interviewed in New York just a couple of weeks ago, is absolutely certain he did not throw the match, because she said just the way he looked, and she saw it in his eyes, that he wanted to win that match.
And what's interesting is, despite the title of this, Battle of the Sexes, and this somewhat contrived conflict, the two of them actually became friends later on in life.
They did. Bobby was saying a lot of very negative things about Billie Jean King because he was this chauvinist, this self-styled chauvinist, but they became very close later in life and actually talked the day before Bobby Riggs died in 1995, and they told each other they loved each other.
Really a fascinating read into sports history. Don Van Atta from ESPN along with us here on the Florida Roundup. Finally, enjoy it while it lasts. Saturday, it may be the last time. Get out the big bass drums and the sousaphones. It had been an annual affair, more of an occasional one over the past couple of decades. And after Saturday, Don, it may be no longer. UF on the football field, college football, Saturday afternoon, the finest of traditions. And we may have to say goodbye to it.
It's heartbreaking.
It is.
it is one of the great rivalries. They've played 53 times, and to actually imagine that they will not play again is very hard to take. I've got to believe, because there's so much interest and, of course, there's so much money in it, that we will see them play again and not too soon.
We got to talk about the money here, because is it the modern college conference design that is tearing these two apart?
It is. It's the SEC that Florida has got now 9 games in the schedule, and the question is whether there's going to be enough for UM. But I have got to believe that because of the interest, not just in the state, I mean, it's a marquee game across the country on Saturday.
That's right.
That we will see these two teams on the gridiron again soon.
And especially if the two teams continue to remain in national rankings, it's a game that has implications come December.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. As long as UM is, you know, Florida in recent years has been the team that's been ranked more than UM. But yes, if UM, and I believe they're definitely headed in the right direction as well, gets back into the national rankings. If they're both nationally ranked teams, TV is going to want to put them together, and the fans are going to want to watch it.
What say you, Canes or Gators?
I think this Saturday I will be rooting for the Canes.
All right, Don Manhattan with the ESPN.
I'll get in trouble with my brother-in-law if I say anything.
There we go.
It
is a family affair when it comes to this time of year. Enjoy it while it lasts here on the Florida Roundup. Don't forget, you can listen to these program once more pregame. Consider it pregame between UM and UF tomorrow morning, 6 a.m. here on LRN. Program produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our public insight network analyst, Steph Farrow. Our executive producer here at the station is Peter J. Mertz. Our technical supervisor, Paul Leary. Stay tuned for the South Florida Arts Beat with Ed Bell here on WLRN. Monday morning at 9, the Sunshine Economy. It is finding work in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.